Welcome, everyone, to our Why I Stay session. It's been a privilege the last 5 or 6 years to take over the legacy of organizing and finding panelists for this classic Sunstone plenary session. Because of our numbers, we're going to be broadcast into a couple of other ballrooms, and we've had to start breaking a few other sessions out against these because of the size of our room here. But we're so grateful that you're here. We're grateful to Toby Pingree, who was the board of directors chair when this type of session got started. We have had a slide up here off and on as we were trying to get some other technical stuff going here to just note the passing of some very wonderful and important people who've meant a lot to Sunstone through the years. As we can see here, we lost Carmen Hardy, a wonderful scholar, mostly famous for his work on Mormon polygamy and from a historical perspective. Ron Walker, many of you will know, was a historian as well. He worked and was one of the three authors of the Mountain Meadows Massacre book that came out through the LDS Church. Wonderful scholar, historian. I'm going to talk about Ardeen Watts in a minute. Charles Chas Peterson, Edward Kimball, many will know from many years of Sunstone, also a former board member. We lost Marvin Hill, another wonderful historian. Bert Wilson, Eugene England's best friend from Idaho growing up, a wonderful folklorist. It's probably one of the best Sunstone articles ever, was an exploration of Mormon folklore and all those stories that you told on your mission that you knew happened just in your mission for sure. You know, Bert helped us understand how folklore comes and changes and moves from different traditions. And we're grateful for also for the wonderful contributions through the years of Melissa Proctor to Sunstone. So we wanted to note when we had most of us together. Just last Saturday, for those who didn't hear, Ardeen Watts passed away. Ardeen was one of the wonderful fixtures at Sunstone. I began coming in 1994. And to encounter this man with so much energy, who was like a live wire in every sense of the word, who for whom music just flowed, was one of the great experiences of my life. So for those of you who don't know of Ardeen Watts, we're going to play about a 45-second clip of him leading a Sunstone session in For All the Saints. And then we have changed the opening song. You've now been passed out to Now Let Us Rejoice as a rejoicing Ardeen Watts kind of tribute from what we had in the original printed program. But I want you to see this man in action just for a few seconds. And this is about the third verse moving into the fourth verse of the song For All the Saints. A taste. When I first came to Sunstone and sang in that Pillars of My Faith section, and Ardeen was leading, there was nothing but tears. Because not only I had found my people, the people I needed to be with, the people that helped me feel not alone, but to sing with him, it was so emotional. I can only compare it to when I go to Paul McCartney concerts and we all sing the end of Hey Jude together. You know, you just can't help. You just can't help but be so, so moved. For those of you who are interested and want to learn, there is going to be a memorial service on the 19th, Saturday the 19th of August, here at Gardner Hall, here on the University of Utah campus. It'll be a celebration of Ardeen's life. They ask that everybody bring your own copy of the Hallelujah Chorus, And among the things that we'll be doing together is singing Hallelujah. So this is, I didn't mean to single him out, but it's just such a fresh loss from us. And he was so important to Sun's Home for so many years. One of the continuities you'll catch here is this beautiful Alan Eastman over here. Ardeen used to play and lead together until he discovered this massively talented Alan, and that allowed him to come up to the front and just lead and teach us. So we're grateful for that continuity. When Kim McCall, when Ardeen's Parkinson's and some other things kind of took over and he was had to retire here, Kim McCall, who's going to lead us today, came out with a white wig and a beard, and his first time was also a tribute to Ardeen. So in the tradition of Sunstone, enjoy singing, Now Let Us Rejoice. And then following that, who's our prayer again? I apologize. Oh, we didn't have prayer. Okay, I'm sorry.
We'll have an interlude after the second verse. Sing with the, I don't know if I can really imitate him the way I direct, but I might. Okay.
It's my privilege to introduce our four wonderful speakers today. As it says in the program, this is a session of people who have been in the wars, people who have made it to some sort of peace, some sort of resolution, some sort of comfort level that says, I can stand in my tradition despite all of the challenges and feel oriented and feel centered, perhaps to feel called to be with these people despite everything. And it's always a wonderful thing to celebrate them. And I appreciate this tradition and, again, the privilege of organizing it. We're going to slightly change some of the order here, and a couple of these bios were a little older than they used to be and left out certain things, so I'm just going to quickly introduce the order as well as read you fresh bios for the people who need to. Robin Linkhart will be our first speaker. Hers is one of the bio changes. Robin is a member of the Council of 12 Apostles, the lead missionary quorum of the Community of Christ. She's assigned to the North Central USA mission field, and she also oversees the Restoration Heritage Seeker Ministry. I don't know, are you going to share anything about what that is in your talks? No? Okay. Ask her later. Her previous assignments include President of the Quorum of 70, and she also serves on the Theology Formation Team and the Ecumenical and Interfaith Ministries Team. In speaking here at Sunstone in this session, she joins Bill Russell and a few other wonderful Community of Christ fellow travelers here at Sunstone in this tradition of sharing how every tradition has those challenges and that ability that we all must find to be whole within them. We're grateful to also have John Gustafrothal, who will join us as our second speaker. He's served as a board member, as senior vice president, and now he is the president of Affirmation, LGBT Mormons. And he has written extensively about the challenges faced by LGBT Mormons and their families and friends in Sunstone. I was honored to, I think, publish the very first time John shared his experience of being called back to Mormonism, and even as an excommunicated member of finding that strength and that ability just to transform his ward in Minnesota in a way that I hope he'll share about today. He has been legally married to his husband of 25 years since July 2008. He's a believing Latter Saint, and for the last 12 years, as mentioned, he's, even though excommunicated, he has served in his Minneapolis ward. Maxine Hanks will join us next. She is an independent scholar of women's studies and religion, a feminist theologian, and a chaplain. As the program notes, that in 1992, she was the collector and editor of a seminal book called Women and Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism. The year before my first Sunstone, she was among the September 6th. Those who were excommunicated all in September 1993, and it was a very interesting and challenging time for so many of us. And as Maxine shared several years ago, she chose to be rebaptized to re-enter fellowship within the church 5 years ago. I think this is exactly the five-year anniversary of your coming back in. We're grateful to hear from her. Finally, we're going to hear from Nathan McCluskey. He has a doctorate in political science from the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. He and his wife, Gina Colvin, live there in Christchurch, New Zealand. And he is a union convener for New Zealand's National Statistics Agency. And I just know that you're going to love, many of you already know Nathan. He's been wonderful here for there, and I think we're going to love the beautiful way that he wears his Mormonism. So for 18 minutes each, maximum, we're going to now hear from these wonderful four panelists. Thank you.
It is really wonderful to be here with all of you. I have to confess, I was quite surprised when Dan invited me to be on this panel, and deeply touched because I'm not LDS. I am a lifelong member of Community of Christ. Today, I want to share with you about why I choose to live out my walk with God as a member of Community of Christ and why I stay. Before I begin, let me note just a couple things. First, when I speak the name God, I am referencing what I understand to be the triune God, fully inclusive of all dimensions of gender, race, and human diversity. Second, I will reference the church as Community of Christ, with the understanding that the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Emma's Church, reorganized under the leadership of her son Joseph Smith III in April of 1860, is one and the same as Community of Christ. That name officially changed in 2001. I was born into Community of Christ. My earliest memories include a profound awareness of and connection with God. My church was absolutely vital to my experience of God. It kept me grounded, and most importantly, it provided me with a loving, nurturing community no matter where my family moved, and we moved 19 times before my 21st birthday. I was baptized at the age of 8. But my personal conversion to the restoration story occurred when I was 12 years old as I read Emma Smith, The Elect Lady by Margaret W. Gibson, published in 1954. I remember staying up late into the night, reading under my covers with a flashlight, and sensing the profound presence of the Holy Spirit, and devouring Gibson's account of early church history and Emma's life with Joseph. I married the year I turned 23. My husband also grew up in the church. We continued as active members, first in Tennessee and then in Colorado, just 12 miles from where my husband was born and raised. As I grew older, my religious life and study took more serious directions, and my questions multiplied. 3 kids and 5 years later, I found myself deeply frustrated with our congregation of 20 members who seemed oblivious to our needs. My husband was just starting out as an insurance agent working on straight commission. I often say we lived on dirt and berries for about 10 years. I was struggling mightily to keep my head above water, caring for 3 children born 15 months apart, a single followed by twins. Long story short, my husband and I left the church briefly to explore membership in a much larger denomination that was located just a quarter mile from our house. Our venture into another faith community was a pivotal point of decision in my life. Yes, our little white church on the corner across town reached out to us to inquire about our absence. But more importantly, I was faced with the profound need to do some soul searching and embrace a few realizations about myself. I had to take responsibility for making my needs known to others. My little church only knew what I told them or let them see about my life. It turns out that I was rather gifted in looking all put together and handling life well on Sunday morning. The reality was, those were the only 3 hours of the week it looked anywhere close to that. I also recognized that if I was totally honest, I wanted people to think I could do it all and be the perfect wife and mother. So I didn't say a word to anyone about how difficult things were with only one car, and my husband needed it almost all the time, and few friends. I was new to the area, and barely enough money to keep a roof over our heads and food on the table. And I certainly didn't share about the fact that keeping 3 babies in diapers, fed, dry, and healthy around the clock was about to break me. I won't go into the decades of discovery and feminist awakening it took to unravel the intricacies of those cultural and self-imposed expectations. But I will say this. It is amazing what people who love you can and will do when they have a clear understanding of what you need. During that time of wandering away from the church and wrestling with many questions, I also heard the voice of God say to my heart, Robin, this is where I am calling you to live out your life of faith. These are your people. All will be well. Not as the world sees, but as I see. We returned to our little white church on the corner. That was my point of decision. The first of many key growing moments of moving beyond second-hand religion into first-hand faith. The journey continues. I believe it is a lifelong endeavor. I want to tell you why I stay. I stay because as imperfect as we are, I see the face of God in the people I serve. I stay because we are willing to ask ourselves difficult questions and struggle to come to a better place of being and loving. Even questions that tear us apart and cause us to bleed, like the ordination of women and full inclusion for LGBTQIA+. I stay because we continue to listen for God's voice in a way that we take seriously. We record and we hold ourselves accountable to. We regularly add sections to the Doctrine and Covenants, many of which have been life-changing. I stay because I see in us a commitment to a process that recognizes the worth of all persons and endeavors to give voice to each one, honoring and respecting their contribution to the whole. This is the way we live out common consent. I stay because I see faces among the leaders at all levels, reflecting the diversity of color, gender, socioeconomics, and culture the world over. I stay because I see a people who sacrifice for the greater good of the whole, not just for our own members, but the whole of this planet, and all that God has created. I stay because we are committed to holding Scripture as sacred, without locking it into a flat, literal interpretation or allowing it to be hijacked by political and cultural influences which would distort it beyond recognition in order to serve purposes which benefit dominant races, genders, and people of certain socioeconomic status. I stay because even at our worst, we cling to God's vision of peace with justice, and we dare to call it our own, working with all that is in us to realize God's dream for the world here, now, on this planet. I stay because even though this is where I have experienced life's most excruciating wounds, it is also with these people and with the many other people and places my call takes me that I have experienced the breathtaking presence of the living Christ in ways that fill my soul and make my heart sing. I stay because over and over again I see Holy Spirit moving in and through and among us, touching broken lives, some barely hanging on to shreds of hope. And I witness healing, transformation, and joy, and new life. I stay because this is where I have experienced forgiveness. And this is where I have learned to forgive. This is where I have experienced love. And this is where I have learned how to love. I stay because I see in us an authentic desire to be real and to allow God to have God's way with us. And that, my friends, is incredibly scary. And we are still in the very early stages of learning what that means and where it will take us. But I am convinced that it is central to what it means to follow the Christ all the way to the cross and beyond. I want to share something with you that I have never shared publicly before. I had the privilege of staying in the home of my dear friends, Paul and Levina Anderson, while I attended the Sunstone Symposium summer of 2012. The Sunday before the symposium, myself and several others from Community of Christ attended services at Paul and Levina's ward just down the street from their house. We went to everything. I attended Relief Society, Gospel Doctrine, and Sacrament Meeting. It was an eerie, out-of-body experience. Of space and time. I remember sitting in the pew during sacrament meeting, watching only men dressed in white shirts and ties, presiding over and leading the meeting. My heart was in my throat like a rock, as my mind was transported to the nearly identical scenes and sensations of my childhood, youth, and young adult life in Community of Christ. In fact, I nearly gasped out loud as the full realization of how far we have come in such a very short time flooded through every fiber of my being. I say to you now, my friends, if Community of Christ had not had the faith to listen to God's constant whispers urging us forward into uncharted waters, and had the courage to step out in response and take action, resulting in transforming change, without a doubt, I would not be here with you today sharing about why I stay. Community of Christ is not perfect. We have our fair share of moments where we screw it all up completely. We are, however, willing to acknowledge our failures, to learn from them, and make changes accordingly. We will continue to make mistakes, to love imperfectly, to miss the mark, to stumble, and even fall flat on our face. I am confident we will continue to get up, brush ourselves off, and try again. We are not a large or wealthy church. In the context of Western culture, which measures success by acquisition of wealth and breadth and depth of consumer-based programming, we are not competitors. We are who we are, Community of Christ. Friends, it is not easy to follow the way of the living Christ. And most certainly, it is not easy to be a peculiar people faithful to the spirit of the restoration, which is a spirit of adventure, openness, and searching. Building community is arduous and even painful. But the struggle to understand what it means to be the people of God in this time and in this place, and to fully live into the recognition that our welfare resides in the welfare of the least of these, takes us straight into the heart of God's dream for the world. A world where all are welcome and there is always a place at the table. I want to be part of making that a reality. I leave you now with these words from Carlo Coretto, which speak to me deeply about the struggle of choosing to live together in and with a faith community actively engaged in the process of becoming beloved community with all people. How baffling you are, O church, and yet how I love you. How you have made me suffer, and yet how much I owe you. I should like to see you destroyed, and yet I need your presence. You have given me so much scandal, and yet you have made me understand sanctity. I have seen nothing in the world more devoted to obscurity, more compromised, more false. And I have touched nothing more pure, more generous, more beautiful. How often I have wanted to shut the doors of my soul in your face, and how often I have prayed to die in the safety of your arms. No, I cannot free myself from you, because I am you, although not completely. And where should I go? Thank you.
I was excommunicated from the church in 1986. I am a gay man in a 25-year-long relationship with my husband, Yaron Gustav Rathal. We were legally married in July 2008. Over the years, people have asked me how it is that I could consider myself Mormon if I'm not a member of the church. What covenants are there for me to renew on Sunday morning, sitting in the pews as I pass without partaking the sacrament tray to the person sitting next to me? To the extent that there is a relationship between me and God that has the church as a context, real as it is to me, it is invisible to outside observers. And that's okay. I stay because I cannot deny what I know. God is real. Jesus Christ is real. The Spirit is real. When the Spirit is present, I know it is present. When it is gone, I feel its absence. When I obey its promptings, I have it with me. And when I disobey, I lose it. I can and do lose it on occasion. And with the Spirit, my life is infinitely fuller and richer and more peaceful and meaningful than without it. So I obey to the best of my ability. When I lose it, I do whatever I need to do to get it back again. And one of those things is to stay active in my ward and to keep the discipline of the church and the gospel in my life. I stay because God has told me that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is his church, and it's where he wants me. It's where time and time again, as recently as the last time I attended my South Minneapolis ward 2 weeks ago, the Spirit meets me and teaches me. My heart is softened. The Lord shows me my weaknesses and works with me and draws me to him. At times I have been reassured. At times I have been corrected. I find myself renewed as I meditate on the sacrament prayer, as I make those promises in my heart and ask for the Lord's help to keep those promises. I have had sacred experiences with my priesthood leaders, including through blessings they have given me, that convinced me of the reality of priesthood power. I have witnessed and been the beneficiary of the miraculous healing power of the priesthood. I revere the priesthood as I revere God. I have been blessed to have my fellow saints claim me as one of their own and care for me and encourage me. They accept me and my husband with love and without judgment, and they trust me to find my way forward through faith and hope and love the same way as everybody else. I have one of the best wards in the church. Are there complications and contradictions? The main one is that I feel prompted to stay true and committed to my husband. We experience all the challenges of any couple, as I've observed, both among those who've managed to make their marriages work as well as those who haven't. My marriage to Euron is a school in which I learn patience and sacrifice and empathy. I learn what it is to be one with another human being. My relationship with Euron does not cause me to lose the Spirit. To the contrary, I've experienced a richness of the Spirit as I've honored my commitments to him. What does this mean? I trust that the seeming contradictions between my experience with my husband versus church teaching and policy will all work out. It will work out for me personally as long as I keep that Spirit guide in my life. In my last meeting with my stake president, he simply counseled patience. "What is time unto the Lord?" he said. I'm learning patience above all. Time and life and experience will grind away everything ephemeral and show what is eternal and what is not. The older and more experienced I become, the more I'm aware of my weaknesses and failings and my need for grace. I have learned how utterly dependent my happiness is on the first principles of the gospel, faith and repentance. Faith is not merely belief. It is allowing oneself to trust divine providence, even when one cannot see the ends toward which that providence guides us. Repentance is not merely an act. It is a posture, a way of life, an openness to learn and grow and become. When we fall, it is a willingness to pick ourselves up and start over. I'm grateful for the grace God has shown me time and time again, often when I knew myself unworthy of it. This is a journey that must be renewed daily. It does not matter how far I've traveled in my journey up to this point. I will never reach my destination if I ever stop walking. Sometimes I can barely believe I've been on this path for 12 years already. There have been a couple of moments in my journey with the church when I've wondered how I would continue on with it. Not necessarily doubted that I would continue, but wondered, as in having a sense of amazement. One of them was in the immediate aftermath of the November 2015 LDS policy on gay families. On the afternoon of November 5th, 2015, I was chatting on Facebook with other leaders of Affirmation, when news of the policy began to break in social media. It wasn't until I saw copies of authenticated text from the new handbook that it really began to sink in. My initial personal reaction was not positive. I think among the first words out of my mouth were, "That's barbaric." It seemed vindictive to me. In that moment, it looked to me like revenge for the church's stunning defeat in the Supreme Court in Obergefell versus Hodges, and to me it was barbaric to use children to strike at the parents. I knew and still know the personal situations of enough LGBT Mormons in same-sex relationships raising children in the church to immediately grasp what impact this would have on them, not to mention the larger impact this could have on LDS attitudes toward the LGBT community. As I continued to reflect, there were two dominant thoughts in my mind. The first was that any hope of broadening connections between the larger LGBT community and the church had been dashed. During my time of service as senior vice president and as a member of the Board of Affirmation, I and other leaders in the organization had been working hard to broaden those contacts. We had opened up a dialogue with church leaders at all levels and had been meeting with LDS Church Public Affairs since December 2012. We were striving to make room for LGBT Mormons to claim their faith as Latter-day Saints, as I have since my profound conversion experience in September 2005. In September and October 2016, Affirmation conducted a survey of its membership worldwide. Based on the survey data, which looked representative of the Affirmation community that we served, over half of the Affirmation members reported being active in the church prior to the policy. After the policy, that percentage dropped to somewhere between 20 and 25%. In a January 2016 leadership gathering in Los Angeles, Affirmation leaders expressed anger, a sense of betrayal, and even guilt for having encouraged LGBT Mormons to engage with the church. We had observed widespread trauma among LGBT Mormons and their families. My other dominant thought was less a coherent thought and more a sense of gnawing hurt, sadness, and doubt. If I had to put words to it, I would say I was wrestling with my sense of my own place in all of this. Hadn't the Lord told me to come back to the church? Hadn't the Lord reassured me that my relationship with my husband was blessed by him, that I should honor it and safeguard it as one of my greatest personal possessions, treasures? I was running for president of Affirmation and had made the decision to run based on personal prayer and fasting and a clear sense that this was something the Lord wanted me to do. How was I supposed to do this now? I remember the morning of November 6th. I got up out of bed, went downstairs to kneel in our living room for my daily prayer and to begin my scripture study. I remember feeling heartsick, wishing that what had happened the previous afternoon had been just a bad dream. But then I began to pray. I began to pour my heart out to the Lord, saying simply, "Please help me to understand. Please help me to know what to do." And it was like a light went on. Peace flooded through me. My mind was filled with light and reassurance. And the Lord, in essence, said to me, "Don't worry about this. I've got this one. And you and your husband are still okay." It was hard for me to articulate what this personal revelation meant because my sense of things was so counterintuitive. I didn't talk a lot about it. People were hurting so much. Most members of the LGBT Mormon community saw the policy as a giant step backwards, as a triumph of bigotry. I saw it now as a step forward, a step through. We had to go through this to get to the other side. And the other side would be very, very good. What had we lost? We had lost some illusions about liberal progressive evolution of church policy on this issue. I was always skeptical of that kind of a scenario. I always suspected that this issue could only be tackled head on in the form of listening deeply to the real stories of LGBT Mormons, followed by doctrinal searching and prayer for new revelation. What we hadn't lost was ourselves, our stories, in their depth and totality. The church might not understand us, but God does. God sees us. God saw me and said I was okay and that I need not worry and that he had this one. In the weeks after, I saw signs that ordinary mainstream believing heterosexual Mormons were really struggling with this. My bishop called me to see if I was okay. We met and talked. He told me that by his estimate, at least 60% of the members of our ward were struggling with this. The Sunday after the policy, a stranger came up to me in church and asked if I was John Gustav Rathall. When I told him I was, he told me that he was investigating the church. He said to me, "I just wanted to know I'm with you on this one." Other members of my ward came up to me and hugged me and promised me that I was not alone. At the end of November, my mother passed away, and I spoke at her funeral. I told the story of her personal revelation, telling her that her gay son was okay, and prompting her to accept my husband as her own son. After the funeral, it seemed like there were a procession of members of my dad's ultra-conservative Springville, Utah ward coming to me and wanting to talk about the policy, many of them with tears in their eyes. In early December, I asked for and was quickly granted a series of meetings with church representatives and leaders in Salt Lake. I met with an apostle. And after telling some stories of the trauma that I had observed among ordinary LGBT Mormons, I said, "On the drive up here, I was discussing the policy with my father. My father was very troubled by the term apostate. I am now defined as apostate under this policy. I told my father that I did not believe it was the church's intention to stigmatize me or others in my situation. The concept of apostasy is simply used to draw a line between what the church currently understands as doctrine and what it does not. I asked the apostle, was I correct in what I told my father? And his response was that what I had told my father was exactly right. It was clear to me that in his willingness to meet with me, there was a desire to engage, to draw in and include, despite very difficult doctrinal understandings. After writing about this meeting in a blog post in Times and Seasons, I was accused of lying about having met with church leaders. The disbelief was proof of what I already knew about the situation, namely that it is more complex, and our leaders recognize it as more complex than labels like apostate are widely understood to imply. Yes, there has been defensiveness. There has been retrenchment and doubling down and intensification of anti-LGBT attitudes in some quarters of the church. But there has been an opening up as well, an opening up and a deepening of dialogue. For good or for ill, this is an issue that the church can only move through, not back or away from. The policy did create genuine trauma for LGBT Mormons, and it has been a duty of mine as president of Affirmation to make space for people to distance themselves from the church. But I believe that some of us are called to stay, and the Lord has a very important role for us as part of his plan to move us not away from or around, but through. My testimony has never required members of my ward to be nice to me, though they are nice to me. Nor has it required that the church treat me as equal. It has nothing to do with membership of the church somehow collectively holding correct beliefs about everything. It does not piss me off when somebody says something stupid in Sunday school or priesthood meeting. My testimony doesn't require an aesthetically pleasing account of church history. As an historian, I like my history messy, by the way. I like it human and real. The hand of God is more recognizable in that kind of story. I don't know what to make of the Book of Mormon other than to say that it is the most spiritually profound and transformative text I've ever encountered. For me, the jury is out as far as Book of Mormon historicity goes. I haven't been satisfied by the critics that it's a fraud, but there are certainly aspects of the text that are puzzling if we want to take it literally, which the text itself somewhat demands of us. I suppose that's fundamentally no different from any other foundational scriptural text that exists anywhere. But I certainly know that the Book of Mormon is true in the way that is most meaningful to me, which is in the reading and the application of it. For me, the church is not true in spite of the flaws of its members, in spite of our individual and collective missteps. It is true in them. It is true in our bearing with one another through them. The scriptures are more or less an archive of human error and divine correction. The trueness of the church is in having an authentic relationship with a living God who is drawing us into a more godlike life. That's what priesthood at its core is about. That kind of relationship, which demands the discipline of priesthood, necessarily involves us making both individual and collective mistakes and requiring correction. I'm not sure God's plan works any other way. So I'm here, I'm queer, I'm Mormon, get used to it. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
Dan, thank you for that beautiful tribute to R. Dean. I met R. Dean Watts at the excommunication vigils, and I can tell you he was the light and life of that time, and we wouldn't have gotten through it without him. The title, Why I Stay, implies that I remain despite some desire to leave. That doesn't describe me. I'm a member of the LDS Church because I prefer to be over all other options. So my title would be Why the Church Works. Jesus said in the Gospel of Thomas, "Do not lie. Do not do what you hate. For all things are plain in the sight of heaven. If you bring forth what is within you, what you have will save you. If you do not give rise to it, what you do not have will destroy you." I did not attend the LDS Church from 1983 to 2012 for 28 years, other than a few funerals and holidays. I lost my faith in 1983, and I was excommunicated in 1993, so I had no reason to attend. I faced the very same issues you all face today. Church history, issues in church history, doctrine, scripture, gender, race, and policy. I had to find my own answers alone in the 80s. I stayed in Mormon studies, but I entered other spiritual traditions and practices. So returning to LDS Church membership after 28 years outside was a very big deal, a major life transition. How could I return to a space I occupied in a previous stage of life without compromising my progress or endorsing things that I don't believe? And how could I relate to others who hold different beliefs from mine? Or in Fowler's stages of faith terms, how could a 5 or a 6 communicate with a 4, a stage 4 or a stage 2? These are the questions I took to God. And the answer I got was to rely on faith, compassion, and God to seek healing, belonging, and ministry as an active, temple-attending Mormon. God challenged me to a new phase of life and a new ministry, a more demanding spiritual practice and discipline. That divine direction has mentored me ever since through every new duty or dilemma. and it was the very same voice that had guided me back in 1993 through excommunication, telling me that it served a higher purpose. And that same voice accompanied my ministry work for 20 years. That same wisdom prescribed my return to the church in 2011. I love the LDS Church. It is my family. Our tradition of vision, revelation, new scriptures, gendered gods and theology, universal salvation, sacred temples and rites, fasting and praying, lay ministry and testimony bearing. I attend church to immerse myself in the Spirit of God, the collective power of many souls gathered together. Leaving a hospital chapel and returning to the LDS Church felt like leaving a private meditation room and coming into an auditorium of light. When the Dalai Lama spoke in Salt Lake in 2001, he said, "Every faith has a piece of the truth, but those reared in any faith should stay with their own faith. But they should look more deeply. They should implement its teachings more seriously and deeply." At that time, I was engaged in Mormon studies, but not in LDS practice. So his advice to go deeper into practice planted a seed in me that worked on me and haunted me and finally blossomed 10 years later. Going deeper into LDS scripture, teachings, and practices became my new spiritual discipline. I saw new meanings, evidences, and connections within LDS texts that indicated that there had been a more sophisticated and complex idea or intelligence behind them that was there the whole time, but I hadn't noticed. For example, the fullness of the gospel as both the lesser or preparatory gospel and the higher gospel conveyed through church ordinances and temple ordinances in DNC 84 and the King Follett Sermon. Joseph Smith asserted the need for both as a rigorous, complete path of initiation or formation from faith to exaltation, which is very unique to Mormonism. Mine is not a nuanced Mormonism or a new Mormonism or any of the other terms floating around on the internet. Mine is a deeper Mormonism, a deeper reading and engagement of Mormon history, texts, and theology that excavates unseen meanings and spiritual truths embedded deeper within them. Finding the truth in flawed or literal or mythic teachings is not the same thing as defending error or harms, which also must be seen and dealt with. But true ideas can be extracted from less true packaging. Or as the Gospel of Philip says, truth did not come into the world naked, but came in types and images. The world will not receive truth in any other way. It is necessary to be born again through the image. Enter through the image into the truth. This is the restoration. This describes Joseph Smith's process of seeking spiritual truth in all places. Or as the Doctrine and Covenants says, all truth is independent in that sphere in which God has placed it to act for itself as all intelligence also. Joseph Smith looked for the light of truth within symbols and stories, both mundane and religious. He created imagery, text, ritual, and architecture as containers for deeper spiritual truths. I'll mention a few more deeper readings that have become my spiritual practice in returning to the church. The number one thing that brought me back and is central to my practice is lay ministry. The LDS Church is a lay faith where every member is a minister, authorized to teach, preach, and lead, called and set apart to offices of ministry which operate via priesthood powers. This may be why some members who leave the faith feel an ineffable loss of something inexplicable. Only after studying sacramental clergy formation did I realize that I preferred a lay ministry over an exclusive clergy, and that my own forsaken LDS faith had the most robust and elaborate lay ministry of any. DNC 25 reveals that Emma Smith was ordained to an office of ministry, parallel to Joseph's and Oliver's, and that her ordination coincided with her confirmation, suggesting that they were simultaneous. The promises offered to her are extended to all. Originally, the terms ordain, confirm, and set apart were often interchangeable. So if Emma's confirmation as a member was also her ordination to lay ministry, some of that sense still survives, as all church callings today are formally set apart by the laying on of hands. Another practice that I have used in returning to the church is dialectic and synthesis. A dialectic is a unity of opposites. Dialectical method is an engaging of opposing points of view to find truth through a proposition, a thesis, and a counterproposition, an antithesis, as in Plato's dialogues and Socratic method. The outcome of this process might be refutation or a combination of assertions, a synthesis. Hypothesis and contradiction result in a transcendent third thesis, truth. Socrates used the dialectical process to find truth, but he saw truth as a greater good than dialectic. Dialectical method can be seen in the writings of Joseph Smith in Mormon theology. For it must needs be that there is an opposition in all things, says 2 Nephi. And Joseph Smith wrote, by proving contraries, truth is made manifest. Greek dialectical method was later developed further as a triune process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Thesis is the beginning proposition. Antithesis is the critical perspective or negation of that thesis. And synthesis solves the conflict between thesis and antithesis by reconciling or integrating their common truths and forming a new proposition. No synthesis is possible without antithesis, and neither one are possible without thesis. This triune formula can apply to our relationships in life, including our relationships to religions, churches, spouses, careers, jobs, family. We might be in a thesis stage with our marriage, or an antithesis stage with our religion, and perhaps a synthesis stage with our career. Returning to the LDS Church is the synthesis phase of my spiritual path. Coming back full circle to integrate all the parts of my journey, not rejecting any of my previous phases, but knowing that all were necessary for me to integrate their common truths. It is a deeper, more demanding spiritual discipline, and it is utterly authentic. Staying, leaving, and returning to the church are all valid phases of our relationship to religion. Mack Wilberg's Requiem perfectly embodies for me that synthesis of the seemingly incongruous Mormonism and sacramental Christianity. He wrote it in 2006 while on sabbatical in Massachusetts, the same year I was there at Harvard Divinity School on sabbatical. That work of music mirrors my own synthesis of ministry from Christian to Mormon liturgy. His music has comforted and restored me whenever I have felt discouraged, because it captures the healing power of God's love, which is big enough for anyone, with power to make all things new, no matter how much was lost or how much pain, suffering, or conflict has transpired. God can heal it. Another strategy is resolving conflict or chaplaincy skills. Dialectic and reasoning can only take us so far. Ultimately, language and verbal modes of knowledge can't go beyond the symbolic realm of word and image into the transcendent. That requires the mystic, spiritual, the revelatory. At some point, we have to move beyond dialectic or reasoning of opposing views into a higher transcendent view. Spirituality can bridge the gap between the known and the unknown. Mediation by the Spirit of God or Christ can move us beyond our own limited subjective views. This requires seeking divine help and turning to Christ or God as our true mediator, who can reconcile conflicting perspectives by transcending them from a higher view. When I returned to the church, my leaders and I found ourselves on new, uncharted ground, unsure how to proceed. So we all stepped back, prayed for help, and relied on the Spirit of God for direction. That was our process. We weren't following a rule book. Accessing a higher wisdom beyond all our positions was how we proceeded. Otherwise, I believe my return would not have been possible. My bishop and stake presidency became my partners in healing. They became my pillars, lifting me beyond the past, the fear, the mistrust, into our higher, better selves. The church became my family. Since that time, I've served as visiting teacher, Relief Society teacher, young women presidency, young women teacher, and gospel principles teacher. As a quick aside, Last summer, Elder Oaks was ward hopping and dropped into my ward, and he approached me and he said, well, first I prayed that he wouldn't attend my gospel principles class. And the Lord answered my prayer. But he did attend Relief Society, and so outside we were chatting, and he said, I noticed on the ward list that you're a ward missionary. Can that be true? And I said, yeah, it is. I'm a ward missionary. And he said, how's that working for you? And I said, you know, we have a really great time in my gospel principles class. We focus on the spiritual principles rather than history, doctrine. And I said, but I think my real calling is to reach out to the disillusioned and those who've left the church and minister to them and let them know that they're loved equally. And he looked at me and he said, that is wonderful. So, quick aside. Belonging, resolving conflict. Since then, whenever any fear or disagreement arises at church, I use that same formula to step back and ask God for direction, to help me move beyond my own view and understand the other. And it has worked every time. It's not about persuading others to my point of view. It's about understanding where they are and how those two positions work together, even though they may be very, very different. Sometimes my position facilitates their process and breakthrough, and sometimes their position facilitates a whole new breakthrough for me. Our progress is connected, though we have very different views. We still affect each other, which is why people feel threatened. We all affect each other far more than we admit. Rather than dominate or pull away, if we stay in there and try to stay in balance with compassion, we can heal each other. My bishop has admitted to me that he really wishes that he had my knowledge of church history and theology. He often says, I'm just a humble, bumble person. I don't know anything. I wish I could be like you. He had no idea how much I needed and depended on him and how much I learned from him. They need us. They need our knowledge. And we need them. We need their help. We can still be ourselves and still learn from each other, rather than have the entire ward limited to the bishop's or the Relief Society president's own orthodoxy or stage of belief. All stages of belief can work together. True ministry means that we are in the role of the mediator. An effective, healthy, healing ministry uses two basic principles of chaplaincy. Number one, you don't have the answers for others. They have it within themselves. So our role is to hold a space for them, their process, to help them bring forth what is within them. Number two, we can't project or transfer our own view or perspective onto others. Don't make it be about you. It's about them. Honor their process. Don't judge, reject, or invalidate where they are. And of course, this goes both ways. Don't accept their projections and transference onto you and your process. Let them know when they are intruding, overstepping on your process. The minute that any of us project, transfer, or impose our position on another, we have just hijacked their narrative and we have just left the ministry. We're not being helpful. At that point, we're doing harm. And we do it to each other, all across the spectrum, from ex-Mormon to inactive to active. We all do it. The point is to notice when we're doing it. We also need to recognize the vital role of shadow work, dealing with the feared, unknown, avoided aspects of Mormonism and also of ourselves. In the 1990s, it was a minority of us who confronted the Mormon shadow. Now, today, it's a critical mass on the internet, a majority. It's not about believers versus critics. It's about the larger religious shadow. We're all facing the same issues. We're all in this together. There's plenty of pain, anxiety, stress, and faith crisis to go around. We all deserve support in this process. Every one of us, every one of you, no matter where you're at, you deserve support. Rather than fearing, avoiding, shunning, invalidating, criticizing, or punishing each other for being in a different place. That only makes an already grueling process far worse. This shadow work that we are undertaking in Mormonism is not the end of faith. It's not the end of the church. It's a vital, necessary process of growing into spiritual maturity and wholeness. We need many perspectives in order to understand Mormonism, the full diversity of gifts as they're described in the Doctrine and Covenants. I've often told Sandra Tanner, who's an old friend of mine, that without her work, I wouldn't know what Mormonism looks like through her eyes. And the same thing is true of Elder Packer. I needed Elder Packer's perspective. I needed to see Mormonism through his eyes as well. Last but not least is synchronicity, arising like signs that I am on the right road. I'll give a few examples, like meeting Elder Packer on my way into the approval interview for my rebaptism, and then just accidentally running into him on my way in, and then meeting Elder Eyring on my way out, who had facilitated my return. Or my first day at church, when the Relief Society president ran up and hugged me and said, "We love Levina." That was a sign that I was doing the right thing. Or that Michael Quinn happened to be visiting me when I was going through my readmission process, and he sat patiently in the most Christ-like way and let me process the whole experience with him. Or returning to the Salt Lake Temple in October 2013 for the first time since October 1978, the weekend the church sustained African ordination. And then seeing an African man represent Jehovah in 2013 and take me through the veil. Or my second trip to the Salt Lake Temple in 2014, encountering the stake president who had excommunicated me in 1993 for the first time since then, as he hosted and greeted my temple session. At the end, we cried and hugged each other. Or a member of Levina's old bishopric who had always supported her was called to serve in my bishopric. The list goes on and on, too numerous and too precious to share. I'll end my comments with my favorite passage from the Book of Mormon since the first time I read it in 1970, Ether 12:27. If men come to me, come unto me, I will show unto them their weakness, for I give unto men weakness that they may be humble. And my grace is sufficient for all men that humble themselves before me. For if they humble themselves before me and have faith in me, I will make weak things become strong unto them. Thanks.
I've been blown away by those who have spoken today. And I'm glad that Robin Linkhart didn't go just before me, that she went first, because I was about to join the community of Christ. But thanks to the next two speakers and some fantastic ward missionary work by Maxine Hanks, for the time being remaining firmly grounded. Dan's been quite specific about the fact that this is to take 18 minutes, and I've timed it to 18 minutes, but I realised that it didn't include any time for me crying or you laughing at me. So if you promise to do your best not to laugh at me, I'll promise to do my best not to cry. Well, the first thing I learned in preparing for this is that I hadn't given much thought previously as to why I stay. So I decided to ask Gina why she thought I stayed. I mean, after all, you're not following the rules, by the way. That's it, the deal's off now. She analyzes every other aspect of my behavior, character, and personality, so why not this? In 2 minutes flat, she had a page of numbered reasons for why I stay. Apparently, there are 7 reasons I remain a fully participating member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Who knew? Well, Gina did. I was excited to read them because usually when Gina does this kind of thing, which is almost daily, the results are quite entertaining. It's a bit like hearing a child's school report in a Monty Python skit. There'll be a kernel of truth, but the detail will be so exaggerated that it starts to sound like an Old Testament story. However, on this occasion, what she wrote was actually pretty solid. I'm guessing she didn't have time to embellish. So I thought I'd share 6 of them because they not only reflect some of the important reasons I had considered presenting, but because I do really value Gina's ideas. For the most part, I find her insights pretty prophetic. I would have shared them all, but Dan's reasonably close and he said he'll kick me if I go over time. You won't? Oh, well, in that case, you will. Okay. However, before I do that, I want to borrow some words that were directed at Gina by an angry Facebooker following an unexpected podcast recorded by John DeLynn on a drive to a remote location in upstate New England last year. John had initiated a discussion with those in the car, including Natasha Helfer-Parker, on polyamory. I guess editing content is not John's strong suit. A bit like me in that regard. So the whole discussion ended up posted. I suppose Gina was caught revealing her personal preference for and affinity with heterosexual monogamy. As a result, the Facebook feedback was for her to check her effing privilege. I was in Wellington Airport for work at the time I read this, and I laughed and laughed and laughed. In fact, so hard I was beginning to get innocent bystanders laughing at me laughing. While the irony was lost on them, it had found a receptive home with me. So I thought it best if I name and check my effing privilege, just in case the same woman is in this audience and comes up to me afterwards to tear a strip off me. As you can probably see, I'm white. Except when using an American accent, apparently. I'm male, which may be less obvious, but I think it's best kept that way in this setting. I'm heterosexual, married, at least for the time being, sealed for time and all eternity. Just when she thought she could escape. And I'm middle class, although Gina often tells me I have no class. I imagine I'll be getting that comment after this. I recognise that this gives me an advantageous profile in the church. Well, let's be honest, I don't really recognise it because I'm a beneficiary of it. But I've been told that that is the case, and it's very obvious by those who don't have it. I've been inclined to trust them on this since winning the Nathan Club Apostolic Picking Pool regarding the replacement of the last 3 apostles, whereby I picked all white, tertiary educated American men from Utah and hit the jackpot. The stakes weren't high, I got a free meal out of it. Prophetically picking that divine conformity, I thought. But it also reminded me of what I am not. So let me tell you about my underprivilege. I am not an American, a businessman, or a lawyer, which probably does reveal at least some degree of resistance to following orders in the pre-mortal realm. Despite these significant setbacks in my path to deification, let me share with you some of the many reasons why I still stay, as proposed by Gina, sweetie, gorgeous girlfriend, Colvin, with which I concur. Reason number one, quote, "It's a story narrative that works for him. It's very domesticating and proximate and gives him a sense of his own personal power." That is frickin' true, mate. I think it makes up for the fact that I have limited power at home. It doesn't seem to matter how much I tell Gina that it's my role to preside in our home. She just runs roughshod over my presidential direction. In fact, just on Pioneer Day, I discovered she's letting our 14-year-old boy have his girlfriend in his bedroom in direct contradiction to my express wishes. James Bond never had to put up with that kind of crap. At church, where I am the ward mission leader, the missionaries refer to me as master. I've now begun referring to them as slaves. Now, I want you to know that if I was living in this country, I wouldn't say that, because I know you have a sketchy past in this regard. But in New Zealand, it's not an issue, given the fact that we've never had slavery, because we don't have a constitution. You like that one, Terry? I can tell them where to be and when to be there, and they dutifully show up and follow orders, including to 6 a.m. ward missionary coordination meetings. In fact, one of them, the assistant ward mission leader, is now looking after our children in New Zealand. It's awesome. If I was to say to my wife, as of tomorrow, we'll be having 6 a.m. family Book of Mormon reading on a daily basis in line with President Monson's prophetic counsel at the last general conference, she'd just look at me and itch her nose with her middle finger and say something like, "You have fun with that, sweetheart. Monson's doolally." I love the personal power the church gives me. I sure as hell ain't getting it at home. The personal power, I mean. Reason, just before this started, Gina came up to me, she said, "You're not going to talk about my nipples again, are you?" I'm not. She didn't say I couldn't talk about her breasts, though. Reason number two, it provides purpose, quote, "It provides purpose without having to make up his own life's purpose and think through the complexity that will involve," unquote. That's very true. Life is complex. In fact, it's complex enough. The more thinking I can get someone else I trust to do for me, the better. That leaves me with more energy and time to deal with the remaining complexity without feeling overwhelmed. I mean, imagine if I decided not to stay. I'd have to renegotiate every aspect of my life. There may be some people in the room who've had to confront that. Maybe I'd start with following civil laws. Seems reasonable. But that means trusting politicians more than prophets. That's unappealing. And I don't even live in the land of the free, in the home of the disturbingly undemocratic electoral system. The church provides a whole roadmap for mortal and post-mortal life. It's so beautiful. I love being given a purpose I can live into. Having a purposeless life would suck, I think. Reason number three, quote, It's infantilizing, and he doesn't mind being babied. I confess that I am a youngest child, and after almost a quarter of a century of marriage, I am still remarkably interested in Gina's mothering bits. They're so lovely. And I can't deny that the church provided me with access to those. Without the church, there's no way I would have married someone who was endowed. It's going to be interesting tonight. I suppose on a more general level, the church has taught me that I am a child of God, that I have divine parentage, and through the nurture God provides me when I'm ready, I'll be prepared to become an adult like him. In the meantime, I'm very grateful for the advice, counsel, direction, guidance, and babying God gives me so that through my unashamed dependence on them, I am nourished, sustained, and supported as I learn to stand on my own two feet. I think it's pretty cool. I love being babied. The church helps to remind me that I am not abandoned. Not abandoned by God or so many of my brothers and sisters. And their love helped me to feel that. Reason number four, quote, "It provided him with opportunities, blessings, and privileges that transcended his class position, and he's grateful." Dang straight. I'm so grateful. The church has definitely given me social lift. I grew up in what we call in New Zealand a state housing area. This is where people who don't own their own homes and can't afford market rents live. The housing is provided cheap by the government. People who grow up in those areas tend to stay working class, underemployed or unemployed. The church taught me to be more than society told me I was. I went on a mission and served with some Americans of very, very average intelligence. That doesn't include my zone leader, Sister Suzette Smith, who's there in the audience. But those missionaries, they told me that they were going to college when they got home. I thought, if that missionary who doesn't know where New Zealand is, or what the word transubstantiation means, or that there's such a thing as atheists, or that chugging a 1.25-litre bottle of Coke doesn't cure intestinal worms, or that Egyptologists didn't concur with Joseph Smith's translation of the Abrahamic papyri, or any number of other facts that seemed unsophisticated to me, could go to university, then I would probably be able to do that too. Because of the church, I also met and married someone else from a working class background who had changed her stars. Due to her exposure to educated people in the church, and wasn't likely to give me a choice as to whether I took advantage of the cheap tertiary education New Zealand provides. As a result, my assets, income, and social power are so many more times that of my father, that I can't ignore the impact the church has had on taking a weedy state house kid with limited prospects and making him a person of influence in a range of settings and having him believe that his story is far from over. It's delightful. I love the class position I now enjoy. The church has been critical, indeed a critical factor in lifting me up the ladder. Reason number five. He likes the status quo, unquote. She's right about that. I have to be pretty solidly convinced to change something because I usually make sound decisions to start off with. But I have previously been accused of drawing water from dry wells and flogging dead horses. In these situations, I either didn't recognize that the well was dry or that the horse was dead. Or, on occasion, that the dead horse had been thrown down the well such that even if I was to get the bucket to the water, it wouldn't be safe to drink. For example, I have a 2002 Mini Cooper. I really like it. It's an exceptional automobile. It is economical because it only has a 1600cc engine. It grips the road like it's on rails because the chassis is set up like a go-kart, and it has 16-inch tyres. It's light, so despite its small size, it'll still do 200 kilometres an hour, and it has a good overall safety rating. However, it has a downside. The gearboxes are mud. I've had to replace 3 or 4 of them. I've lost count. At $5,000 a pop. For this reason, Gina has been on at me to sell it and replace it with something more reliable, probably with origin somewhere in East Asia. But I can't bring myself to part with this magical machine. I just love driving it so much. It's familiar, it's enjoyable, it's special to me. There's certainly a parallel in my sticking with the church. It's familiar, it's enjoyable, and it's special to me. It's excellent. I love the predictability of the church. Finally, reason number 6, quote, in this context, he's had spiritual experiences that affirm the truthfulness of the church. At least, this is how the church asks him to interpret ecstatic spiritual charism, unquote. There is no doubt that I have experienced what I would describe as ecstatic spiritual charism. I have heard voices. I have had visions and dreams. I have felt overwhelming and extraordinary physical, emotional, and psychological union. I have witnessed and been party to events that I only feel the word miraculous is apt to describe. I have most often been brought to these either through direct involvement in the church or they have manifested connection with the church in some discernible way, but not always. If these experiences did not reflect the influence of God in my life, then I can honestly say that if there is a God, I am truly clueless as to what, where, who, or why that God exists, or how they manifest themselves in the lives of human beings. That influence has consistently led me into greater affinity with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and towards a deeper desire to know God and Jesus. Answers to prayer have been so clear and strong on occasion so as to seemingly overcome every natural instinct and sensible consideration. I'm well aware that some would describe that as insanity. A fine example would be the direction to accept 4 permanent foster boys into our family. By doing so, we tripled the number of children in our family and had 4 boys under 4. But taking our total number to 6... For weeks, I woke up in the middle of the night with cold sweats and nightmares. I went to check the bedrooms just to confirm that I was imagining things, only to rediscover with horror that our lives really had changed in an unfathomable way. It took quite some adjustment. When you put that in the context of Nathan, who loves the status quo, along with the fact that both Gina and I were PhD students at the time, it really is acceptable to describe it as insanity. I can't attribute the decision to take those boys to an evolutionary response, although the cold sweat certainly could have been. I can't attribute it to logic or reasoning that in some way this would be of benefit to us. Even now, I see no utilitarian advantage. I can only conceive of this as a being with greater vision than me, with more love than I had, interfering with my status quo, disrupting our lives and giving us an opportunity to put our hands in theirs in order that some good we potentially only now see through a glass darkly may become clear through the eons of time. It's fantastic to me. I love that despite Gina's very accurate assessment of my native character, the church has opened me to the possibility that God will spiritually influence me in such disruptive ways that I do much more to positively impact the lives of others than I ever otherwise would, knowing what my natural inclinations are. And I have ecstatic spiritual charisms regularly. Last Sunday, as I sat in a modified gospel doctrine class in the Parley's Creek Swahili branch, The Zambian teacher told us or asked us what we would say to Christ if we met him. I guess I must have taken the question more seriously than usual because I couldn't stop the tears from flowing. As I tried to say that I would express my gratitude to him for what he has done for me. A quarter of a century ago, I remember seeing a very tender-hearted single woman share her personal testimony of Christ's atonement, and I was significantly moved. At that moment, I said to myself, I want to marry a woman like that. Little did I know it at the time, but within 3 months of that event, I would marry that same woman. You see, I don't seem to be able to separate these marvelous experiences either from God or the church that brings me into contact with them. The way they have and do move and shape my life with such purpose, bearing fruit that is both good and extraordinary to me, traps me in the church by my own free will and choice. In the presence of what I feel is God, believe our angels and see our witnesses. And that, my fellow citizens, is why I stay. Thank you.
An amazing 97 minutes.